Fond of. I'm very fond of both loving kindness and just loving kindness. And it wasn't always so. It's one of the surprises that came to me as I did Buddhist practice. Because I didn't come to Buddhist practice in order to develop loving kindness or learn about it or anything like that. And the early years of my practice, when I heard about loving kindness, I thought it was too sentimental. And it also seemed rather contrived, because it's done as a meditation practice where you, in a sense, evoke the experience, the feelings of loving kindness. And first by evoking it towards yourself, having loving kindness feelings of friendliness, of love or compassion for yourself, and then extending it out towards others. And it seemed somewhat contrived and artificial to create loving kindness. You don't create love, it just happens. If you create it, it's not real, I thought. So I kind of stayed away from it and wasn't interested in it. And then when I started doing Vipassana retreats, the Vipassana teachers would often guide us in guided loving kindness meditation. And I was kind of, rather austere Zen monk. And so I just tuned the teacher out. And then to my surprise, at some point in my mindfulness practice, my heart just kind of blew open. And at some point, what the result of the practice was a tremendous amount of warm feeling, loving kindness, a feeling of love and joy. And it wasn't like I was looking for loving kindness, but I think that's often what happens. If you open your awareness, open your heart, kind of remove some of the barriers to your heart, let it kind of unfreeze it in a sense, I think that often the kind of natural response of an open heart will be experiences of joyful loving kindness. And once I found it in myself, very strong, powerful experience, feelings of loving kindness during retreats, then I could identify with the formal meditation practice that was taught. And then when the teacher started guiding it, then I had some reference. I thought, this is what they're talking about. This is the emotion, this is the feeling, this is the wish. And then it was easy then to evoke it because it was so close at hand. And it didn't seem artificial anymore. It simply felt like, just kind of turning to what was already there and allowing it to shine. Loving kindness is one of, there's a number of them, but there's one of the spiritual virtues or spiritual emotions which Buddhism makes a lot of. It's very important in Buddhism. It can be understood as simply the expression of what happens when you become more awakened, when you become more present. And naturally, I think loving kindness is one of the results. So it's not something to be cultivated, just something you should learn to recognize. But also, it's also about how we relate to the world around us, to others. And the practice itself, the mindfulness of practice itself, which some people have pointed out, is often given with instructions that make it look very passive. It seems like just simply passively sitting there, being aware of what's there, not trying to do anything or change anything, just accepting what's there, and knowing what it is fully and completely. And so it seems somewhat passive. And how does that help you in your daily life? Well, it helps, but it kind of lacks some kind of active way of being in the world. And one of the descriptions, one of the ways the Buddhist tradition talks about how to live in the world, how to engage other people, how to be involved in relationships, is by talking about what's called the Brahma Viharas, the four divine abodes, which is loving kindness, sympathetic joy, compassion, and equanimity. And these four ways are ways in which you're encouraged to live in the world, encouraged to kind of engage with other people. So rather than just simply accept what's going on, there is an active part also where you participate with these expressions of these feelings. And in order for these feelings not to be genuine and not to be kind of contrived in the situation, it's very important to learn to be able to recognize these within ourselves. And in my case, I learned about it from being on long retreats and having my heart opened on the retreats. For other people, it comes from actually doing this loving kindness practice, the metta practice itself. And at first, it maybe seems a little bit mechanical or strange to do it. And then with time, it becomes more of a natural part of our life. But I think it's very important to learn to recognize it. And in mindfulness practice, as you know, a lot of it is just learning to recognize what's there. But there's a lot of things which we don't recognize because we're not used to seeing it. We haven't become familiar enough with it. And for, you know, my example, which I often give, was my early years of practice. I wasn't supposed to be an angry person, so I couldn't see my anger. And so we often talk that way, by the shadow side, the kind of negative side of our personality. But often the so-called positive emotions or wholesome emotions, the joy and the love and the compassion that we might feel, that also needs to be recognized in order to have a chance to flower or to be there. And often that's what people don't. Some people focus so much on the more painful or difficult parts of their life that they never really develop the ability to see or recognize the hints or of loving kindness, the hints of love or compassion, sympathetic joy that might be poking its head, or might actually be more than just poking its head, kind of wants to break out. It's kind of repressed. So learning to recognize it is very important. There's been a lot of discussion over the last years about the difference between therapy and Buddhist practice. And it's a whole kettle of worms, as they say, to try to kind of sort that out. But I'd like to kind of, in this light, make one generalization, underscore that it's a generalization. And this is at least, you know, it's not only my observation, but I'll just take it to be my own. It's for tonight. There's a tendency when you go to therapy that you go to therapy because you have a problem. And you want to have a solution to the problem. You want to feel better, you want to be happier, you don't want to be so depressed. You have some problem with your spouse or relationship. There's some kind. So, and often the therapist then, even before you come into the room, is already thinking about, you know, how the therapist can solve the problem. They're listening for the kind of thing that therapist wants to hear, and for that gate, the avenue into that person to help, kind of help them with a problem, figure out what's wrong with them, and offer them a solution, offer them something. And of course, this is a generalization, not true for all therapists, but maybe it's true as a kind of broad generalization. And so they talk sometimes in therapy circles about counter-transference. About how the therapist, not only does the client have a transference on the therapist, but the therapist has a counter transference back on the client. And one of the counter, and sometimes it's said in therapy that the counter transference is there before the transference, because the therapist already has an agenda of what they're looking for and what they want to see there, and who they're supposed to be in relationship to the patient. So maybe that's the way it should be. You know, it's a monetary transaction. You're paying someone to take care of your problems, so the person should be thinking about your problems. it's maybe the way it should be. The difference I want to point out with Buddhism, I hope this is a difference, is that when you meet another Buddhist or you meet a Buddhist teacher or a meditation teacher, that person ideally is not looking to try to figure out what your problem is. That's the first thing on the teacher's mind is, what's that person's problem? What am I going to do to fix it? But one alternative possibility is a teacher just simply there to respond to whatever comes. And they don't have any agenda. And it's really great in the Zen tradition when you go for an interview, the teacher's actually sitting in meditation when you come in. So they're completely, you know, not completely maybe, but to some degree kind of quieted out whatever agendas they might have, and their mind is quite fresh because they're in meditation when you come for your interview. And they just, this person's here, that's interesting, what does this person have to say? So you say something to it, and the teacher then responds depending on what you said. And you don't have to talk about your problems when you go see a Buddhist meditation teacher. The other thing that a Buddhist teacher might do, maybe different from a therapist, is a Buddhist teacher might not at all be oriented towards your problems, but might be oriented towards oriented towards those beautiful parts of who you are, and is ready to see that and ready to kind of point that out to you. Have you noticed how beautiful you are when you're being honest? Or you noticed how wonderful it is when you feel some joy? Or don't you feel some joy now? Or whatever. There's a whole different way, I think, in Buddhism we meet each other. We don't meet each other as problems, per se. Um, So learning to recognize something else in our fellow people, fellow humans. There's a beautiful passage in the Lotus Sutra about a bodhisattva called, I think it's called Never Disparaging. And this bodhisattva goes around, he spends his whole time bowing to everybody he meets and saying, oh, I can see you're a Buddha, or I can see you're going to become a Buddha soon. To everybody. And people kind of start hitting him and chasing him away. And, you know, you foolish person, of course I'm not going to be a Buddha, or I'm not a Buddha, or, you know. And then he goes and he continues. And no matter how much people kind of chase him away, he still sees the Buddha nature in that person. He sees that some people in Christian tradition say he sees the divinity in that person. So learning to recognize. Thomas Merton wrote, Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts. The depths where neither sin nor desire can reach. The person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way, there would be no reason for war, for hatred, for cruelty. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. So to recognize some other aspect of each other, of ourselves and other people, I think is part what's happening in Buddhist practice also. And we don't want to only dwell on our difficulties and problems. We want to start recognizing fully our joys and our pleasures and the strong aspects, the beautiful aspects of our personality, who we are. It's said that in the light of awareness, the unwholesome aspects of our life diminish. And in the light of awareness, the wholesome aspects grow. One of the reasons for teaching loving kindness in the context of Vipassana practice is that the spirit of mindfulness practice hopefully is a spirit of friendliness to our experience, to whatever's going on. Rather than being in an adversarial relationship with what's going on or criticizing what's going on, we want to kind of be friendly and hospitable to whatever's going on in our experience. So by doing loving kindness meditation, it kind of gives you a feeling, gives a kind of sense of what a hospitable relationship might be with our experience. So it actually informs the mindfulness practice itself. Primarily, metta, or loving kindness, is the wish that other people be well. That's kind of the basic definition of it. Is hoping or wishing that someone else would be well, in whatever well might be in any given situation. And so it can be a very kind of matter-of-fact kind of feeling. And it can come from a tremendous sense of heart connection with someone. Tremendous sense of openness of heart that you really want to, you really want to feel kind of love or compassion or joy in the other. And you really kind of want it. You kind of, I don't know. You're just deeply, from in a heartful way, hope that they feel better. That you want to be. They want to be better. So often, loving kindness practice is done by saying very quietly in your own mind, kind of silently. It's kind of like prayer practice, maybe. Though I'm kind of shy to use the word prayer. But it's kind of prayer in the sense that it's you use phrases to do the loving kindness meditation. And you say these phrases to yourself. You say things like, may I be happy. May I be well. May I be free of suffering. May I be filled with joy. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. May go on and on. You can make up your own phrases. Just go on and on and on forever. And then you do the same thing for others. And I think it's very significant, especially in our culture where we tend to be unwilling to some degree to honor ourselves enough that loving, in Buddhism, loving kindness is practice is always supposed to be done first towards oneself. It's supposed to start with yourself, because you're just as deserving of your own love, your own care and care, as anybody else is. So the loving kindness practice then is done first to yourself. And it's said, if you can't do it for yourself, you can't really do it for anybody else either. So normally then you start by yourself and you wish yourself well. You find some way, some sense that you have, some feeling you have, that you want to be, that you care for yourself, that you concern for yourself, that you want to wish yourself well, that you deserve to be well. So you bring that to yourself. And then once you've done it yourself, then you extend it to others. As soft-heartedness. There's an interesting concept in relationship to loving-kindness. That's the concept of the near enemy and the far enemy of loving-kindness. And what's the near enemy of something? Something that looks so similar to the thing, the virtue itself, that you sometimes confuse this thing with a virtue. And the far enemy is that thing which completely kind of demolishes the virtue or the feeling. So the near enemy of loving kindness is said to be desire. There's kind of the desire for something. Not desire for wishing someone well, but that it's self-centered desires. You want something for yourself. Some kind of self-centered affection out of some kind of need is often mistaken for a loving kindness which has no, you're not doing it out of any need you have for yourself. So that means you're not indulging. Like when you offer loving kindness to yourself, you're not doing it because you're indulging in some kind of self-centeredness, because of some kind of attachment or need to feel better. You're doing it out of some genuine sense of love for yourself. And hope you can see there's a difference between those two. And the same thing with others. So especially desire or love, affection for someone else can often be tinged with attachment or need, in which case it's no longer loving kindness. So that's why it's called a near enemy, because it can be so easily confused. And the far enemy is considered to be hate. And hate and loving kindness can't exist together. And because they can't exist together, sometimes we teach loving kindness as the antidote for anger or hate. And sometimes when anger or hate is really strong, and no matter how much mindfulness practice you do, it just has the upper hand, then sometimes it's useful to do loving kindness practice as a way of as an antidote in order to calm down and settle it out for a while so you can begin seeing the situation more realistically, more accurately again. I think you always want to start with yourself. Actually, the way it goes is traditionally, you do yourself, then you do what's called a benefactor, someone who's helped you, or like a parent, or someone, as you said, benefactor. In the West, we often say a friend, someone you feel close to. In the Buddhist tradition, and in the old tradition, they say your friend should be someone of the same sex, because it's so easy to confuse other kind of feelings if it's the opposite sex, they say. But we don't really do that, make that distinction here, I think, in the West. Just a friend. So it's just first you do it yourself. That's supposed to be the easiest. And then you do it to a friend who's easy to, or someone you care for. You do it to a child you know, or a relative, or someone. Someone who's easy to do. And then you do it towards a neutral person. Someone, you know, who you hardly know or don't have any particular feelings for, the mailman or something. Why is that funny? And then you do it to the person you have difficulty with. So you do it to other people first, and only when you've done it there, then you go to the person you have difficulty with. And because it's difficult to do with the person that's difficult, so you don't want to kind of jump in and do something which... it could be counterproductive even. It's very interesting what happens when people do loving kindness meditation. Sometimes what it does, you know, it softens the heart to do it. And in softening the heart, sometimes you feel all soft and vulnerable and open, you feel very loving and friendly and hospitable and nice things like that. And sometimes you soften the heart or soften the edges of the heart, and what's buried in the heart? Anger and animosity and fear and sadness and grief and all these things that are buried in the heart. And so people are doing loving kindness meditation and suddenly they're crying or they're furious and then they say, well, something went wrong. You know, I must have done the meditation wrong. But actually, rather than it being wrong, it's actually worked. It's kind of, you soften the heart enough to kind of to allow what's there to express itself. And once it's being expressed, you can take it into account. So it's not so uncommon for people to feel kind of the opposite, whatever that might be. And then usually the instructions is, then stop doing loving kindness practice and start doing mindfulness practice on that. And that's useful to do. So loving kindness. It's really one of the jewels, one of the real treasures, I feel, of mindfulness practice or of Theravada Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism puts more primary emphasis on compassion as the primary spiritual emotion or virtue that's cultivated. And I think it's really beautiful that they do that, in part because compassion is the real motivating factor. It can be a very powerful motivating factor in your practice. Practice really kind of your own practice. To practice based on compassion for the world puts tremendous zeal or enthusiasm in your practice. And so in Mahayana Buddhism, you're practicing not only for yourself, but for other people, to help other people. And so compassion is a very important motivator. In Theravada Buddhism, the primary one is loving kindness. And I don't want to get into a discussion of what is better. I don't think makes sense to talk about that. But one of the things about loving kindness and focusing on that primarily is that loving kindness is often seen as the foundation or the base for the other three Brahma Viharas, the other three divine abodes. So loving kindness is kind of the basic expression of wanting others or wanting yourself to be well, having loving feelings towards the world. Then when you have the open-heartedness of loving kindness, what happens to it when it meets the world? If the world is suffering, then a heart which has loving kindness in it will express itself as compassion. A heart of loving kindness which meets someone's joy, then will respond with sympathetic joy. And so it kind of, in a sense, loving kindness, if you cultivate loving kindness, the other emotions will come when they're appropriate, for the situation they're appropriate. And that's one of the reasons why we teach it in our tradition. And we don't really teach the others very often, sympathetic joy or compassion. We really put tremendous emphasis on loving kindness. And if you do a retreat with us, longer retreat, almost always, we do at least one guided loving kindness meditation each day. We're doing one period of meditation a day. And what I'm thinking of doing is, if Sylvia Borstein can come down here, I'm going to ask her to lead you in the loving kindness meditation during the regular meditation period. So maybe the last 15 minutes or something, she can guide you through the loving kindness meditation. And for those of you who are new, you've had a little bit of an introduction to it now, and you can just kind of follow along as she leads you. And sometimes in our tradition, we do whole retreats, 7-day retreats, 5-day retreats, 3-month retreats. The only meditation practice you do is a meditation practice on love, on loving kindness. Can you imagine such a thing? And actually, I know some people right now who are in Barrie doing 6 weeks only doing loving kindness meditation. And in Thailand, there are monks in Thailand who are known for, they're famous for the loving kindness. Isn't that a great thing? To be famous for something. So people go there to kind of get a hit to this person's loving kindness. And, you know, he spent 30 years cultivating loving kindness. Isn't that great? And what if our cultural heroes were people who had gifts for loving kindness? rather than gifts for whatever, for shooting, kicking field goals or whatever. And I'd like to end with a couple of quotes. The first quote is from one of the books by Carlos Castaneda. Gennaro's love is the world. He was just now embracing this enormous earth, but since he's so little, all he can do is swim in it. But the earth knows that Gennaro loves it, and it bestows on him its care. That's why Gennaro's love is filled to the brim, and his state, wherever he'll be, will be plentiful. Only if one loves this earth with the unbending passion, with unbending passion, can one release one's sadness. A warrior is always joyful because his love is unalterable, and his beloved, the earth, embraces him and bestows upon him inconceivable gifts. Only the love of this splendorous being, life itself, can give freedom to a warrior spirit. And this freedom is joy, efficiency, and abandon in the face of any odds. This is the last lesson. It is always left for the very last moment, for the moment of ultimate solitude, when when a man faces his death and aloneness. Only then does it make sense. And it struck me that for me, I discovered the powerful arena, the powerful domain of loving kindness, only when I had discovered, I don't know if I want to use the word ultimate, but ultimate solitude, when a man faces his death and aloneness, when I kind of really had met, in some ways, my own death in a way, and my own solitude, then loving kindness arose out of that. And I think there's a way in which, you can only really feel love for someone else if you found your own solitude and found your peace with it. And then from that, I think, come naturally loving kindness. And then I'll read the Loving Kindness Sutra. This is a scripture that the Buddha gave, that the practice of loving kindness comes from this little text. This is the work of those who are skilled and peaceful, who seek the good. May they be able and upright, straightforward, of gentle speech and not proud. May they be content and easily supported, unburdened, with their senses calmed. May they be wise, not arrogant, and without desire for the possessions of others. May they do nothing mean or that the wise would reprove. May all beings be happy. May they live in safety and joy. All living beings, whether weak or strong, tall, stout, average or short, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy. Let no one deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. As a mother watches her child, willing to risk her own life to protect her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, suffusing the whole world with unobstructed loving kindness. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, may one remain mindful of this heart and this way of living that is the best in the world. So I hope that in the next week or whenever you'll learn to recognize your own joy and love when it arises and honor and respect it, and also learn to appreciate love and joy in others when it arises, so that you can participate in this beautiful world of our Buddha nature. So thank you all. Good night. Hey.
I just got back from New York, so.
Let me give this to her first. This is the woman who's coordinating this whole project through the.